Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the French Connections Tuesday edition. My name is Daryl Bradford Smith, of course. Today's date is the 25th day of August, 2009. Great to have you all here with me for another important broadcast, another important discussion of world events and how we have found ourselves in such a sorry state of affairs globally. And I'm going to honor the French Connection listening audience with a great guest today, someone who I have come to regard here over a very short period of time, but come to regard as a very learned and well-studied man on the subjects that the French Connection has been following for years. He comes to it from a finance background, and we're going to be talking to him in just a minute. A lot of things are happening. Of course, you're watching things hot up on the news, the Zionist-controlled news of this flu virus and how they're going to quarantine people. Massachusetts is actually saying if you don't take the vaccine, they're going to lock you in your home and charge you $1,000 a day fine and all these other things. This is incredible to watch from an American standpoint, especially considering that we've all believed for so long that we lived in freedom. What's happening now is the veneer is being stripped away, and the fact that we don't have many freedoms at all is becoming evident to more and more Americans. But the Europeans as well are starting to discover that their continent is not free. The construct that they designed after the Second World War is beginning to show that it is really a despotic construction rather than a freedom-based one. Here in France, of course, you'll note that Mr. Sarkozy has already declared he's going to force everyone in France to take a vaccine. He's going to be going to be tough getting me to do it. I'll head for the hills, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you'll do the same. But so much has happened in the medical side of things, and that's for another show. I just want you all to be aware that this is a multifaceted and multi-pronged assault on freedom worldwide. Its base and strength is really coming out of the media. And a specific group within a religion, not the whole religion, and I want to make a caveat statement here before we even go into the discussion, that you will find Zionist Jews at the top of this conspiracy, but certainly not all Jews involved. And for anyone out there pushing the idea that all Jews are involved in this crime wave, they need to be avoided. Not only avoided, but possibly investigated as disinformation specialists, because or hateful people, because it's clear to me and anybody who looks into this that not all Jewish people and not all the communities of Jews are involved in doing this. However, I must add a separate statement to say that many Jewish people are badly or under-informed about this conspiracy, and many of them are only now waking up to the facts as they really are, and they too need an opportunity to research this information. So I welcome all people from the Jewish community to examine the problems and the insights that we have on the French Connection, and those of my guest. His name is Jeff Gates. Jeff is a remarkable guest to have on this show. He's worked within finance for a long time. Part of his professional life has brought him into examining how the financial structure worked when he was unaware of who was really running things. And in a private call with him, I mentioned to him that I used to actually instruct people on how to trade in the market, and I always refer to the machinations behind the scenes as a hidden hand in the markets. I didn't know either how things actually were really being run. When it all came to light in my life, I was shocked and even in a state of disbelief for some time. But through research and through examination, I found out that not only was it true that there was a single group running things, but they had a far more important role that they were playing than even I recognized in the beginning. And I think Mr. Gates will echo those sentiments, but I'll let him speak for himself. Jeff Gates, are you with me?
I am.
Well, it's great to have you on the French Connection, Jeff. You know, I've been doing this stuff for a number of years now, and I've been trying to be an honest broker for the truth. And it's a very difficult job, especially when there's so much information out there to process. what you've done here in your book, Guilt by Association, approaches this from a standpoint of how it was built, how this construct came to be, and what its actual effect is in our society, and why we can't seem to ever get any substantive change when we as voters or we as society try to make those changes. You want to tell the listeners a little bit about what your research and what your book is about?
Yeah, the first book is called Guilt by Association. It's the first in a series called the Criminal State series. And the state is the mindset. It's the shared mental state that is the real battlefield for this warfare that you now see ongoing. Now, that's why media is so important.
Yep.
So, for example, in the case of finance, I was educated. My dad was a PhD economist, likewise educated, in what's called the Chicago Model, which is now morphed into something called the Washington Consensus. And the basic premise, to cut to the chase, is that money is smarter than people.
Mm-hmm.
What you simply do is you allow money to seek its highest possible return without regard to any other value out there. And so the hidden hand behind the curtain is really ourselves, because you have somebody offering 5% over here and somebody 4% over there, you're going to go over here. Otherwise, you'd be insane to do anything.
Well, but Jeff, can I ask you this question? It certainly was always being helped in a single direction toward enriching a certain small group of people. If you take a look at the things I've discovered, and say, you know, we are the people allowing this to take place by our indoctrination. However, the profiteers are always the same group, and I've watched them explode in importance over the last 30, 40 years. The number of billionaires from the group that I mentioned in the beginning, the Zionist group, has exploded. They represent, in my research, over 70% of all billionaires in the world, and they're only 0.2% of the population. That's an astonishing comparison of statistics.
Yeah, we're the enablers of this. We've been educated to freely embrace the very forces that undermine our freedom.
Yeah.
A lot of those are embedded in finance. But the current way that finance works, and there's a chapter in Guilt by Association on this, it's what you call a closed system of finance.
Mm-hmm.
No matter how much capital you finance through this so-called capitalist system, you don't create any significantly new capitalists. You just be the rich do, in fact, get richer, and that's the construct of how it's whether it's designed or evolved that way. I tend to gravitate toward your conclusion that it was designed that way.
Mm-hmm.
And so then we had to be educated into this notion to freely embrace that, and that's what makes separating this out between the perpetrators and you refer to, and the enablers who were us at this point.
Well, how in the world did they get us, and how long ago in your research did this process of acceptance of their model begin? Now, I my research goes back strongly into the previous, 200 years ago in the middle American century, but it was also happening here in Europe. What does your research show you about the process of indoctrination into the system?
Well, it gets sort of diffused into the mist of time as you go back.
Yeah.
If you look to how it got embedded in economics and law, which is how I first was embedded in this as a counsel to the Senate Finance Committee for 7 years, I went in with a framework, a way of thinking that was already embedded in me as to how this works. It in part came out of the University of Chicago. It's the one, the academic center most affiliated with this. It then became something called the Law and Economics Movement. And the basic premise was, well, you want human freedom, therefore you need to have free markets. And if you want free markets, you have to have freedom for financial markets.
Yeah.
So you went one, two steps just like that. You went from human freedom to financial freedom. And suddenly you have this financially free closed system whereby, at our own insistence, we're saying, don't you try to inhibit my ability to seek a return. That's like inhibiting me. How dare you interfere with my freedom?
But isn't it interesting that the Hegelian dialectic of controlling both sides of an economic model was at play here during that whole period, especially in the last century, when these same forces were neck deep in the communist model as well. So they were actually taking the other tract as well in this model. And how do we explain that the dichotomy here?
Well, I think it's just that it is. The crowd that's being profiled in this Criminal State series are experts at pitting two sides against the middle while they profit off the misery of both.
Yeah.
And I think you've done good documentation on who funded the red side of the red versus white revolution that became the sort of Bolshevik revolution. And at the end of that, 80 years later, Now I work with Gorbachev's first economic team, brief Yeltsin within a few weeks of him being sworn in. Yeltsin was a perfect asset of this. He enabled these people behind the scenes. By the time the privatization was done in Russia, Gorbachev estimates this crowd stripped out about a trillion. I'm suggesting it's at least half again that much. But you find that six of the top seven oligarchs qualify for Israeli citizenship.
That's right.
That's 84% in an environment that's about 2% Ashkenazi.
Yeah.
So you begin to go back and say, how could that possibly be? And if you look on this side, if you look at what happened with supply side economics, I was there for that from 80 to 87 as counsel. We borrowed a huge amount of money. We pumped it into this closed system of finance, and out the back end we got the leverage buyout and a huge acceleration in the concentration of wealth. And so you now have 25% of the Forbes 400 who are Ashkenazi.
Well, and then there are concepts that maybe you're not even familiar with, or possibly you are, where a lot of the Jews that are at the top of this crime wave, and again, not all Jews are, but the ones that are, there are often Jews involved that are not declared Jews, and we've discovered that through people like Wesley Clark, with people like John Kerry, with people like, you can go down the list, Madeleine Albright, and there are people within Hollywood that are non-declared Jews. We have people within the finance industry that are non-declared, and we've discovered them to be called crypto Jews, which is part of a modus operandi in the infiltration of nations and governments. And I'm certain that that's firmly at play in the wealth distribution game as well.
Well, it's interesting because you find that really you don't need to be Jewish; you just need to have a bias that takes you in that direction. I mean, Pat Robertson is not Jewish, but he's been a huge enabler of this as a Christian Zionist.
Yep.
The Mormon community is just absolutely rife with this phenomenon. And in its senior most ranks, they're not Jewish, they're so-called Christian.
Well, there are a lot of people who believe history shows that some of the leadership level Mormons have had association with Zionism from its beginning, even before Zionism was called Zionism. In other words, they have links back to fortunes within the Ashkenazi banking confines up back in Europe 250-200 years ago. So, and you'll note that not much of their dogma within their religious structure is also comes right out of the Zionist model. You find the Star of David throughout their
Well, their first community was called Zion. They're very clear about all this.
Yeah.
As an aside, I live in Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
When President Buchanan broke up the polygamous communities, he sent 5,000 federal troops. They then had 3,000 Mormons under uniform, marching in cadence with arms. They fled south to Chihuahua, Mexico, and north up into Alberta, and they spread Mormon communities throughout Arizona and up into Idaho. And that's why, for example, George Romney was born in Chihuahua, Mexico. So you find that there's still these communities there that are very, very belief-based. That at the core of this model is people who are masterful at displacing facts.
Yep.
What you can be induced to believe is true. That's why you saw us go into war based on intelligence. It was all based on belief, had no facts around it. You know, it was the Iraqi WMD, the ties to Al-Qaeda, the meetings in Prague, the mobile biological weapons laboratories, the yellow cake uranium for Niger, all of it false. And yet we created a consensus, a belief, just like you have the Washington consensus. You create a belief, and if it gets to be a generally accepted truth, it's enough to displace the facts right in front of you, and that's the modus operandi.
You mentioned the use of Colin Powell in that recent lie spin over there for the war, and you also mentioned something interesting, that because you said, you know, that associative relationship actually bleeds into every walk of life. And I mean, in other words, sadly, if you look on the internet, it's Google and other search engines are run out of Herzliya, Israel, and you'll note that people like myself, I get 3, 4, 5, 6 million hits for my name on certain search engines. Bing is one of them. But the first 10 top things under my website are destruction pieces on my character. And interesting that people will disassociate from me because of something they read that may or may not be true, and a consensus is built to marginalize, and it works wonderfully well, or it works to build a thought process. You want to go into that a little bit? I think it's a big part of your...
Yes, as you'll find in the book, there's a chapter around this called The New Anti-Semitism and how this works to try to marginalize people and discredit them and that sort of thing.
Yep.
And I'm new to this. I've been researching this full-time for 78 months, but I come out of the financial domain. I knew nothing about this. And in the process of my search, I typed in the singular noun, J-E-W, into the Google search engine. And in return, I got a response from the Anti-Defamation League accusing me of being an anti-Semite.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of input and the kind of discrediting sort of control that you find in the information technology domain. And it is generally systemic. You'll find a graphic and guilt by association that shows how the Israelis dominated information technology security. They dominate that industry.
Yeah.
And people think this is a conspiracy theory. There's no theory in any of these. This is just the facts. This is how things work.
That's right.
Unless you understand how things work, then you will tend to be dragged off into a domain where people, oh, that's all theory, that's all anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism is a great charge for misinformation, for displacing your ability to deal with the facts.
Well, and you know, there is a knee-jerk reaction, or even a visceral reaction of people when they hear about the charge of anti-Semitism. I remember when I first started researching this, I was loath to point the finger at Zionist Jews at the very top, because my stomach would actually turn. And I mean, this was really my experience of having been indoctrinated by my entire life's experience on television and media, on news reports and so forth, and it was very hard to get rid of that guttural reaction in myself. It was almost a bile reaction in me, Jeff, that I had, and I think a lot of people waking up right now are still facing that. I've grown past that, of course, but it's there, very prevalent in people trying to come to the truth. Am I correct?
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. That was the case for me as well. I had a very similar gutter, visceral reaction to this, because I said, it can't possibly be true. It can't be a common source. I'm a partner in one of the largest Jewish law firms in the country. I'm on the board of a popular Jewish magazine. I've got a Jewish daughter-in-law. I'm going, this can't possibly be the case. So you tend to self-monitor your own perception based on that.
Mm-hmm.
Yet the unfortunate truth is this does have a common core. And the most unfortunate thing, of course, is for the secular and moderate Jews, who are very much supportive of this work, to say, thank goodness somebody can finally separate these psychopaths and these extremists from our core. If your listeners go search for George Kaufman online, he's an MP and a member of parliament in the UK, and you'll see his very impassioned speech on the floor of the House of Commons when the Israelis invaded Gaza.
Yeah.
He founded something called Independent Jewish Voices. And that's the challenge. I mean, the Jews themselves, if you speak out on this and you're not Jewish, you're an anti-Semite. If you are Jewish, you're self-hating.
That's right.
And you're isolated, you're discredited, this is a tough, this is framed in such a fashion, it's very difficult for people to actually look at the facts right in front of them.
Yeah. Well, I've had, early on. Now, my brother, I was looking into this. He does broadcasts out of Rhode Island and Massachusetts right now. He told me back in the late 1980s that there was a group expanding their influence worldwide that was very dangerous, called the Lubavitchers. And he told me that their association to Sanhedrin and all this other stuff was sinister in its intent. And I remember saying to him at that time, Scott, you're out of your mind. Don't talk to me about such nonsense. And my first response was that vile feeling in my stomach, and I said, you couldn't be farther from the truth. Of course, he was spot on at the time, and continues to be till today. Interesting though that now we're facing new crises, and we're trying to come at this as a matter of urgency, and it's a very difficult fight for many of us, including yourself, Jeff. What is it that brought you to the point you're at to fight this? I mean, you're taking a huge risk, both with your own life and your own financial well-being, because these people are merciless. They're psychopaths. Could you talk a little bit about what you know about their psychopathy, their sociopathic tendencies, and what it is that brought you to the ability to look into this yourself?
Yeah, I've been investigating a firsthand evidentiary trail that of someone who's been living inside this phenomenon for 28 years. So what you find in this initial release, and that person's identified only as John Doe in the preface, the initial book was meant to be a very generic analysis. Here's how this works, and the response has been enormously positive. About 2 years into this, I thought everyone I'm looking at has the same psychological profile. I lived in San Francisco for 7 or 8 years, and one of my closest circle of friends were all practicing psychiatrists. So I went into the clinical literature, and I found a definition that absolutely fits. I cut it out and put it next to my computer screen until I could memorize it, and it's now in the book. It's called psychopathy, and I'll just read you the five descriptors from the clinical psychiatric literature, which goes as follows. They have traits such as superficial charm, pathological lying, egocentricity, lack of remorse, and callousness. And that's who we're profiling. So you can be fairly impersonal about this. You know, if you see that that is the profile of someone, regardless whether they're, you know, a Mormon Zionist or a Christian Zionist or an extremist in any community, they're likely going to have this pathology because they are so embedded in their own belief system that they're willing to displace anything except that belief. That is the extremism that this country was founded to escape.
Yes, that's right. Well, but now going back to finance, of course, you know, my research goes back, and you actually went to my website and looked at some of the money changers and, of course, the history of the Rothschilds and so forth. And the seed money that came into America, especially during the Civil War period, you know, Jefferson Davis's finance minister in his government was a Rothschild agent and actually had been working for Rothschild Bank in advance of his Jefferson Davis participation in the South. But we also see him, the bankers out of New York forcing, because of the need, for Lincoln to go to them and get usury money and set up a system. What is it that you see as far as the European connection? Because I've seen the families of Schiff and Loeb and Kahn and Rothschild and Honig and Oppenheimer. These are the names at the very, very, very top, even higher than agents such as Kissinger. He has to go hat in hand to these forces. And we've also seen people like Berkshire Hathaway, manager at the castle of the Rothschilds over in France. And, of course, we've seen Arnold Schwarzenegger standing there beside Evelyn de Rothschild and so forth. Now, we also know that the president of France has been staying in Rothschild-provided houses and working with Rothschild-provided henchmen. What is it that you find at the very top in the finance industry that, since you've been doing the investigating, that brings you back to this very top group?
Yeah, that is accurate. That particular family, of course, dominated banking in Europe and still does, for the most part. And that network is the one that, of course, that advised us both on the creation of the Federal Reserve and of our tax system. Paul Warburg on the Federal Reserve and Felix Warburg on the tax system.
Yep.
Primarily the tax-exempt area, which is where the bulk of the funds under management operate out of that area. So, yes, that's very clearly the case. And I would not have, again, come up to that conclusion but for a first-hand evidentiary trail that takes you directly there.
Well, could you tell me a little bit about the formation of that tax-exempt area? And, you know, I was watching a video, and I'm trying to get in touch with Sherry, what's her name, Sherry Jackson, and the IRS agent who turned against her bosses and came clean on the IRS. She said that in certain tax areas and forms, you know, they give you three choices, type A, B, and C, and she said on many documents the A was missing. And what the A would describe would be exemptions for, you know, and all of the real information that people needed to know about the tax structure, and it would be left off of the documents. But you worked in the behind the scenes on the financial construct, and what is it that you discovered looking through the financial information?
Well, it was only in retrospect, looking back, at what an enabler I was. I mean, we took the amount of funds under management for pension plans, all that operate totally tax-exempt, for about $800 billion in May of 1980 when I arrived on staff, to by April of 2007, it was $17,000 billion. In other words, it went from 8-tenths of a trillion to $17 trillion in that 27-year period. In order to encourage that, we have what's called a tax expenditure, meaning it's money we don't collect. So you give a tax deduction, the money grows tax-free, and because people receive the money in lower tax brackets when they retire, there's also a tax subsidy there. And the subsidy for those funds is about $150 billion a year. It's about the fourth or fifth largest fiscal expense of the U.S. government, and most people don't even realize it's there. That is the pool of money off which derivatives operate, off which all the options operate. That's the pools of money that drive up the value of stocks for executives to pull out the enormous amounts in options. That is the primary generator of much of the mischief that you now see. And it is what I call money on autopilot. There is no overseeing governing body for that. It is money seeking more money. And if you think you can seek some broader value than simply money, like civil cohesion or fiscal foresight or environmental sustainability, try managing that money on that basis and keep your job. You will lose your job, and if somebody wants to sue you, they will succeed. Why? Because we wrote the law to ensure that effect.
Yeah.
So we've taken this, and that is the primary animating force behind the World Trade Organization, with the World Bank and the IMF, and I've worked in 35 countries for these organizations, primarily advising finance ministers and prime ministers, making sure we change the law to do what? To say, you have to believe us. Money is smarter than people. How dare you think you're any smarter than money? Let money do what it does best and just stand back and watch. We'll have orchids growing in the sewers. Just wait. And, of course, what we got instead was oligarchies everywhere this thing operates.
Well, there's an interesting caveat to what you're saying right now. Some friends of mine, including Mohammed Rafiq and David Pidcock, were involved in going over to Malaysia during the Tiger collapse in the 90s and talking to Mahathir Mohamad and trying to convince him to not to get rid of the IMF and World Bank from his country, but to say no thank you to their loan extensions after the crisis. And instead what they told him to do was, because if you tell them to get out of your country, you're going to become a target for war. So what you need to do is say, well, at this present time, we're not going to use your offered monies, and we're going to try to get out of this crisis on our own. And instead, so what Mahathir Mohamad did was used his local resources, his national resources, to rebuild his economy without going to IMF and World Bank. And in fact, they came out of that crisis the first. They were out of the depths of that problem before any of the other countries that surrounded them, including Indonesia and of course the Singapore markets and whatnot. And it worked. And of course,
he was immediately savaged.
Oh yeah, then they got this guy. What's the guy that the homosexual? The guy that he actually, from what I understand, that charge wasn't even necessarily true. But he used it to get rid of the guy that the IMF people had backed to unseat him.
Yeah, and Mahathir, of course, was attacked as an anti-Semite because he said, this is a Zionist operation here, and he called it for what it was.
Yeah.
And he took a huge amount of umbrage at that. But yes, you're correct. Malaysia did pull out on their own. And some countries have said, we're going to hold back and not allow you in here. I know the ANC did that in South Africa, but of course that didn't last very long.
Yep.
And this crowd is so very, very strong in South Africa that you got the results you'd expect.
Well, the Argentines have been trying to stop it and getting bowled over every time they've tried. And, I mean, a first world country thrown into third world status on repeated experiences with the IMF World Bank destroying them. It's almost like they're a model for how to destroy a country.
Well, this again is the power of belief. It is that you really, people really, I think even some of the people who are on the ground actually advocating this, myself included, are genuine true believers in the same sense that a John Hagee or Pat Robertson are true believers. Well, instead of believing that the crisis can return, you think that just seek the financial return.
Yeah.
And that's what's going to sort all these things out. But you can't get that. You can't have that belief to have such stickability, such traction, unless you associate it with credibility. So you found, for example, the Nobel Prize in Economic Science was set up by the Bank of Sweden, the Central Bank of Sweden, and if you look through the list of those to whom it's been given,
mm-hmm.
with one or two, with only three exceptions I know of, it's been given to these Chicago economists.
That's right.
So who are you? Who am I to question? Because after all, these people are Nobel laureates. They certainly must be smarter than us ordinary folk.
Well, I remember when I was at NYU, the fact that there were think it was 18 or 20 Nobel Prize winners at the at the school, and that I remember, you know, telling everybody, well, my school's really good. I mean, it's got 20 Nobel Prize laureates at the school, you know. And I used to walk around telling everybody, you know, like Alan Greenspan, of course, went to my program, and I thought that this was a badge of honor. And what I was basically doing is forwarding the idea that these people had it right.
Well, this is how the Power Association works, and we all want to be associated with things that are credible and, you know, prosperous and all this other stuff. And this is, at its core, this is psyops. This is straight-up psyops.
Yep.
It is indoctrination. It's enabling. And Robert Gates, the Defense Secretary, coined a great phrase. He said, when you're waging unconventional warfare, he said, the most challenging combatant is the people in between. Between you and the reality was your own perception of wanting to be associated with a faculty that had all these people as